And I think I may have told you this question last week, which is a question I get every year around this period of time during the quasi-mourning period of the Omer, which is why does the death of 24,000 Torah scholars get 33 days of mourning? When, strengthen the question, when the Holocaust, the pogroms, the Crusades, the Inquisition, all of that gets how many days of mourning on the Jewish calendar? What's that day called? That day is called Tisha B'Av, the ninth of the Hebrew month of Av, which is in the summer months. And somehow, now, obviously, Tisha B'Av is a much more intense day of mourning than the last 33 days. Right? By the way, Lag B'Omer is not tonight. Okay, just, it was two nights ago. Right?
Two nights ago.
It was Monday night, just so you know. We just didn't think we could get everybody back on another night, whatever. So that's fine. Just want to make sure everyone knows. But the 33rd day of the Omer is when, according to the Talmud, what stopped?
The dying of the 24,000.
Right. The many students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. Anybody know what was the reason? This is important. What was the reason that they that their lives ceased to be? What's that? Lag B'Omer was Monday night. So you're gonna get in trouble. You know, what's that? So it says that they didn't show proper respect to one another, which, by the way, I always feel the need to. You gonna ask about that?
No.
I always feel the need to like when they say that they didn't show respect to another, like they didn't show respect, but according to who they were, like it's the same answer I would give to people when they ask about how Moshe could be punished so severely for hitting the rock as opposed to speaking to the rock. Like, does the punishment fit the crime? He wasn't allowed into the land of Israel. It doesn't seem to be fair. But given who Moshe was, the slightest infraction in deviation from God's command is considered like a big deal. Same thing when it comes to the students of Rabbi Akiva. These are the leading Torah sages of the generation. For them to show not the level of respect, maybe, I mean, no offense to you or me, but I don't think, I hope not, we're going to be evaluated the same way that a student of Rabbi Akiva would be evaluated. They're going to be evaluated in a much more strict manner because they're on a higher spiritual level, so more is expected of them. You know, really quiet. So I don't want to dwell on that. I really want to try to understand. So look at the last paragraph. This is an article written by Rabbi Pinchas Stolper, of blessed memory, who was head of the OU. And he says that during this period of time, Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students who lived during the Roman era died from a mysterious God-sent plague. Why? So you guys said it a minute ago. Ross just said it because they didn't show proper respect. Lag B'Omer is celebrated on the 33rd day because that was the day the plague ended. The students stopped dying. Now, there are a couple of problems. Number one, why does this event, tragic as it is, merit 33 days of mourning, when greater tragedies, when I say greater, I mean in numbers. I mean, the Khmelnytsky pogroms alone cost the lives of many more Jews than 24,000.
Okay?
Khmelnytsky. Okay?
But these were Torah scholars.
Okay, well, you're going to start giving... Right. Okay, I know, it's true. Why is the death of Rabbi Akiva's students given so much more weight? Every event in the Jewish calendar, next paragraph, was placed by the divine hand because it conforms to a preset notion of the significance of the seasons of history. We're on the second page. Is it there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Nature and events correspond and intermesh. Why does the sphere period coincide with the joyous holiday of Passover and Shavuot, which in turn coincide with the period of harvest festivities? Asking a bunch of questions. There also appears to be a glaring inconsistency. What were Rabbi Akiva's students guilty of that they deserved to die? So they didn't show respect. So can I ask you a question? If that's the reason they died, then why are we celebrating? I hate to say this, it's going to sound very harsh. Why are we celebrating the fact that they stopped dying if they were somehow deserving of such a severe penalty? If they were deserving of it because they acted in such a low level, you know, relative to who they are spiritually, then why are we celebrating that they stopped dying? And lastly, what is the connection between Lag B'Omer and the revolt against the Romans by Bar Kokhba? there is a big connection. And how does this all relate to Reb Shimon Bar Yochai? Because if you go to Israel today, when people are celebrating Lag BaOmer, they're not just celebrating the death, the cessation of the death of the plague. What are they also celebrating? The yard site, which is the anniversary of the passing of who? Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, Reb Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the lead disciples of Rabbi Akiva, who didn't die, because this is actually a whole speech in of itself, which I gave years ago. What did Rabbi Akiva do after? You can't answer this. What did Rabbi Akiva do right after? I don't know. Maybe you won't know the answer though. What did Rabbi Akiva do after all of his students died?
Started up again, right?
Started up. The Talmud says, "Aya olam shamein." The world was desolate until he went to the south of Israel and he found five new students. One of those five new students was none other, than Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who ended up hiding out from the Romans, living in a cave with his son for 12 years. Yeah. And then incinerating everybody with his eyes when he came out, sent back into the cave, famous story. I spoke about it this last Shabbos. So we have to understand, look at page 2 on the bottom. Some history is important. You guys with me? This is fascinating stuff. You have to understand, much of the material in the Talmud that deals with political matters was written with a keen sensitivity to the Roman censor. By the way, I know stuff was censored in the Talmud, because I was living with one of my rabbis years ago when I was in college. I was having problems in the shir. I was in a very high-level class at YU. So there was somebody who agreed to tutor me a little in my neighborhood in Queens when I was in college. And his name was Rabbi Herschel Milner, of blessed memory. And he was a big Torah scholar. He married the daughter of the Rosh Yeshiva in the Mir. He was in Shanghai during the war. He passed away probably about 10 years ago. What's that?
He was in the ghetto?
He was in the, yeah. I mean, well, he was from Poland originally.
But he
went to China and he was saved. And he married the Rosh Yeshiva's daughter because he was like the top. And I got to learn with him for 6 months every day. Talmud. And we were learning this one passage in the Talmud. And my Gemara had all this stuff about Jesus and his didn't. We literally had different versions of the Talmud. And his was censored and mine wasn't. Because there was all this interesting controversial stuff about Jesus, which I'm not getting into right now. So the Talmud could not speak openly concerning political ramifications events. Why? Because when was the Talmud written, guys? During which era? The Roman era. And anything that could be construed as rebellion, they were very sensitive and suspicious of. In order to obtain a true picture of what happened, you have to piece together from the various historical sources and Talmudic hits. And something goes something like this. Turn the page. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. Okay, it was a terrible event. Now you can say what led to the destruction of the second temple. Right, baseless hatred. The Talmud says that. Good. Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside lay in ruins from border to border. Scores of thousands have died in the fierce fighting. And subsequently from persecution and starvation, thousands more were sold as slaves and forced into exile. You know the oldest Jewish community in the world today? Oldest Jewish community, diaspora community.
Italy.
Rome. As Jill and I went for a Shabbat meal, we got picked up once. We went to Rome. We said, we're not making plans. We're always inviting people. Let's get invited. So we made ourselves look really lonely and hungry. At the end of the davening, we went to some minyan in the great synagogue in Rome. And finally, somebody came over and said, would you like to come? We said, yeah. We went to this family. They spoke no English. And we spoke no Italian, so we spoke in Hebrew. And I said, how long are you guys here? A long time. I said, how long is long? Because my family was in Germany for like 400, 500 years. But we've been here since the destruction of the Second Temple. I said, what do you mean? So they were able to, or we were talking about this, they were able to, they traced their family back to Jews that were brought by the Romans as slaves after the Second Temple is destroyed. That's where the story picks up. What's that? In Italy, they did.
What nusach did they follow?
It's their own nusach. When I was in Israel the last time, down the block was a Roman synagogue. And it's called Nusach Romei. Romei, it's the oldest sitter, actually.
So the entire, like, what was
it's
that?
Very similar to, it's very similar. It's like a...
When you say censored, what was the censoring? Was it self-censorship or the Roman?
Self-censorship. No, self-censorship, okay. Yeah. Scores of thousands died in the fighting. Thousands more were sold as slaves, forced into exile. The Romans considered the Jewish nation defeated, obliterated. Who's been to the Arch of Titus? Rebecca, did you go just now to the Arch of Titus?
I lived there for
a second. Okay, so you know, fine. Has anybody in Arch of Titus? What does it say on the Arch of Titus? It's Judea Capita. What's Judea Capita? Captive or kaput. It's actually the same word. Yeah, that's what they... Yeah, Judea is kaput, finished, done for. Okay? Now, but even... Now, what happened? So what happened? Did Jews stay in Rome afterwards? Some Jews actually stayed in Rome to do what? After the Romans destroyed the Second Temple?
Build the Colosseum.
No, well, they were some slaves that were probably Jews who helped build the Colosseum because we were slaves. But some Jews stayed to do what?
To rebuild
and to fight against them, which they did for the next 100 years. There were all sorts of fighting going on.
In Israel.
People struggled to rebuild Jewish life, recreate Jewish institutions. It was so successful, the most successful attempt at throwing off the Roman yoke of sovereignty over the Jewish vassal state was the Bar Kokhba revolt. Okay? There was a man by the name of Bar Kosiba who got... His name was changed, by the way. This is very significant. His name was Bar Kosiba. He succeeded in organizing a fighting force to rid the land of Israel of the hated Romans. Thousands rallied to his cause, including the greatest Talmudic scholar, Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef. Now, this is interesting. The Rambam, Maimonides, says that Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach, which is a very difficult thing to understand because you think about the Mashiach as being like a religious personality, and it's unclear whether Bar Kosiba was such a person. I actually asked a number of historians and big rabbis, and I got different opinions. Some say yes, some say no. They found a letter ordering a large shipment of lulavim and etrogim. Some dated to the Bar Kokhba time and theorized that this was Bar Kokhba's attempt to, furnish his forces with mitzvot, because he was a religious. Others say that we have other statements. Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't. Thank you, Vinny. That he wasn't a religious personality. It's weird to think of him as a.
The people who say that he was religious.
Yeah.
Do they say that he was going to make a claim to being Mashiach?
No, he never made a claim to being Mashiach. He never considered himself the Messiah. Rabbi Akiva thought he was, and I'm going to come back to it in a minute.
Don't you think he would know?
What's that?
Don't you think he would know?
He never. Well, he turned out not to. How do we know he wasn't the Mashiach?
Because
he lost and he was killed in battle. And that's how, what I've told some of my Chabad friends years ago, that we know, unfortunately, the Rebbe was not the Mashiach, although he had a lot of the qualifications. But if he passes away before doing the other things that the prophets say the Mashiach is supposed to do, like universal peace and brotherhood and all those little things like that, rebuild the temple, then we know that personality is not the Mashiach. But at the time, Rabbi Akiva at least thought he was, or could be. My rabbi, Rabbi Grimblatt of blessed memory, has a theory. He wrote this up in his book, Exile and Redemption. You should all get it. It's an unbelievable book. It's out of print, though. That he thought he can make him into the Mashiach, which is a little, not so different than like what Rav Kook believes. The reason we talked about a few weeks ago, was it just last week or 2 weeks ago, that Rav Kook would hug these secular Zionist pioneers in Israel, even though they were not religious personalities. Yeah, because he thought they were bringing the Mashiach. They never revealed themselves as the Mashiach. They never even looked at themselves in that kind of way. We're just trying to dry up the swamps and find safe haven because we were kicked out of Europe. But Rav Kook, who was a Kabbalist, believed that there was something deeper going on. And Rabbi Akiva not only thought he was the Mashiach, but what he did was he lent Bar Kokhba and he nicknamed him. His real name was Bar Kosiba. The word Kochav is star, because there's a verse in the book of Daniel, which is a reference to the coming of the Mashiach, that a star will shoot out, referring to the Mashiach. He wanted everyone to see Bar Kosiba as the Mashiach and get behind him and support his revolt against the Romans, which was very strong. He put together a military force of 200,000 fighting people. In those days, that's a lot of people. Okay, that's like millions and millions of people today. The Talmud relates that Bar Kosiba demanded that each recruit demonstrate his bravery by cutting off a finger. You have all these things that he did that are not terribly spiritual. That didn't seem like he was a very rabbinic kind of messianic person. When the rabbis protested, he substituted a new test. Each recruit was expected to uproot a young tree. Such was the level of their bravery and readiness. He was like a kick-butt kind of fearless leader. Rabbi Akiva disagreed with his rabbinic colleagues and won over a majority to his point of view. From the military point of view, he felt a successful revolt was feasible. It is said by some historians that 20% of the population of the Roman Empire between Rome and Jerusalem was Jewish. They were actually Romans. There was a story or two about a Roman senator who attempted to convert to Judaism because the Bar Kokhba revolt was sweeping Rome. It was popular. And it wasn't just because Rome had this like was this crushing, mighty empire that, you know, might made right. Whatever you think about Rome, I'm just telling you, they were cruel. They were terrible. A lot of their leaders were awful, like Nazi-level kinds of cruel tyrants. Even though they brought some wonderful things to the world, they certainly did. And I'm not just talking about the way they treated Jews. This is the way empires behaved in those days. So there was this kind of like grassroots kind of revolt that was more than just pushing off. It was like pushing off the bad guy. It was like the underdog. It was a little messianic. There was like a little messianic fervor in the air. And Rabbi Akiva was a big part of it. And that's why the whole students and their students dying during this time is important, according to Rabbi Pinchas Stolper's, this rabbi's theory. And it has a lot of credence. The pagan foundations of Rome were crumbling. Many Romans were in search of a religious alternative, which many of them subsequently found in a mitzvah-less Christianity in the following two centuries. It's before Christianity, guys. Rome then became Christian later on, but this is before, right? Many Romans, what's that?
It's early Christianity.
At this time already?
By the year 90, the gospel was done.
Oh.
Paul was already.
Oh, okay, thank you. Many Romans were attracted to Judaism, significant numbers converted. So when he says significant numbers converted, is he talking to Christianity? Because in order to be a Christian then, you had to first become a Jew and then believe Jesus was the Messiah. So this is after Jesus proclaimed himself Messiah.
Jesus died in the year 33.
Right.
So this is 100 years later.
Thank you. So there were thousands, tens of thousands of sympathizers. So this is, okay, so Christian, all right, thank you. But before the church, if you will.
The church is like St. Peter already established his church in Rome. They already have churches all over.
So when he says here, this is what confused me. When he says here, so many people, and I've read this elsewhere, were converting to Judaism.
So there were two paths that were seen as making Christianity possible. One path was the James path, which was Jesus' brother, who said, you have to become a Jew in order to become a Christian.
Right.
The other one was Paul's thing, which Paul said, this is the religion of the world. And Paul basically is the father of what we know Christianity
today,
which allows for everyone to be Christian.
Right, but the James thing, but when he says here and others argue that there were Romans converting to Judaism.
Okay.
Was it the James thing?
There were Romans converting to Judaism anyway, like that senator that served as senator. There were things that happened like that, but that was just because it was Judaism, just because like what he says, that people are falling out of favor with paganism and the old gods didn't speak to them. And they were looking for something that had some sort of a redeeming quality or like a thought of things are going to be okay because paganism has no promise. Judaism did.
Right, Christianity also.
To have an alternative promise that is much more readily acceptable because it's not ethnically dependent. It's not belonging to a group of people.
Right, it's faith dependent, right.
It's faith dependent, right, yeah. And so that was a very popular thing.
So this is very helpful. So this revolt, would you agree that, therefore, that this revolt picked up on that? Because that's what he's claiming here.
So the revolt picked up on something particularly Jewish. This was already the third revolt. The second revolt had already happened, not in the land of Israel, but like North Africa, so like Libya, Tunis, like Egypt area. That was called the Quietist Revolt, or the Yes, well, I don't know. The Talmud calls it whatever. We don't know much about it. But then this one was basically, it's 70 years after the temple is destroyed. There's no reason to assume the third temple won't be rebuilt 70 years later, right? First temple was destroyed 586 BC. 70 years later, Cyrus the Great allows us to rebuild it. No reason to assume why 70 years pass by. Mashiach comes. It's time to
rebuild it again.
But it was a particularly Jewish revolt, not necessarily Christian, because, you know, the Jews won their sovereignty once again.
Right.
And so that was, the only way to do it. And Hadrian, who was the emperor at the time, right? Hadrian's the
Yeah, he's going to get into Hadrian. All right, thank you. That was really helpful. If the revolt succeeded and the Jews from all over the world united to return and rebuild their homeland, Rabbi Akiva believed they could bring about the Messianic era. So that's what my teacher also argued. He didn't think he was the Mashiach. He thought he could be the Mashiach. He thought by putting his tens of thousands of students behind this basically secular nationalistic revolt against the Romans, he could make out of it a Messianic redemption. Does that sound a little familiar? Because a lot of religious Zionists kind of view Israel today in the same way. Like the early Zionists were not crying to bring the Mashiach, they were just trying to create a safe haven in the world for Jews after the Holocaust. But Rav Kook and some of the other more messianically oriented Zionists felt that, no, we could do something more. We could bring a little Mashiach action going on here.
And that's why early modern Zionism has rehabilitated Bar Kokhba's reputation. Because if you read the Talmud and you leave that alone, you'll see it's a disappointing messianic mess. Right? And even into the early modern age with Shabtai Tzvi and everyone, false messiahs are really no good news, because it means Mashiach isn't here, and also means we have to be wary even more than we otherwise would be. So early Zionists did a good job of rehabilitating it, which is why...
We have such bad history.
We have a bad history of false messiahs.
But here's the thing. Rabbi Grimblatt used the term not false messiah, but failed messiah. He made that distinction. He said it wasn't... A false messiah is like somebody says, I'm the Mashiach, and then it's a hoax. The whole thing was...
Failed is like
it could have been, and now he's going to start answering the original question because it's getting late, okay? Follow with me. If the revolt succeeded and Jews from all over returned to rebuild their homeland, Rabbi Akiva believed they could bring about the Mashiach, right? The great millennia to which all Jews would return to the land of Israel, the temple would be rebuilt, and Israel would lead the world into an era of justice, spiritual revival, and fulfillment. Just turn the page. Now, this is what the Rambam says. The Rambam's writings on what the Mashiach is. Do not think that King Messiah must work miracles and signs, create new natural phenomena, restore the dead to life, or perform similar miracles. This is not so. And this is a very famous passage from the Rambam. The Rambam does not believe that the Mashiach, the person who is the Mashiach, has to be like a miracle, maker. Things can happen through, bless you, through natural ways. Why? And what's his proof? What's the Rambam's proof that it doesn't have to happen miraculously? Because Rabbi Akiva was the wisest of the scholars of the Mishnah, the arm bearer of Bar Kosiba. He said concerning Bar Kosiba that he's the King Mashiach. That both he and the sages' generation believed Bar Kosiba was the King Mashiach until Bar Kokhba was killed because of his sins. Once he was killed, it became evident that he was not the Mashiach. But he's giving that as a proof that the Mashiach does not have to be this kind of out of this world, supernatural kind of thing. It could happen in a normative kind of natural way. Now, to Bar Kokhba and his officers, all seemed to be ready. Rome was rotten, corrupt, captive nations strained at their yoke, rebellion was in the air. Rabbi Akiva gave Bar Kosiba this new name, Bar Kokhba, right, in fulfillment of that prophecy, a star will go forth. Bar Kokhba trained an army capable of igniting the power keg of rebellion, and Rabbi Akiva lit it with one of the most dramatic proclamations in Jewish history, that Bar Kokhba was the long-awaited Messiah. Now, skip two paragraphs. The rebellion raged for 6 years. Bar Kokhba's army achieved many initial victories. Many non-Jews joined the army. It was reported that it grew to 350,000 men, more men than the Roman army. Bar Kokhba was so successful that Hadrian, right, that's the Roman leader, as Shachar just said, called in all of his best troops from England and Gaul. Rome felt threatened. On Lag BaOmer, it is believed by some that Bar Kokhba's army reconquered Jerusalem, and we celebrate that great event today. For 4 years, Jewish independence was restored. Many believe Bar Kokhba actually began to rebuild the temple. Some even believe some people believe that he actually completed it, but I don't know, I guess there's some opinions. There were two Roman legions in the country when the uprising began, one in Jerusalem, one near Megiddo. Both were decimated by Bar Kokhba's name. We're on page 5. We're going to skip a little. He starts going through the details of the wars. Hadrian sent his best commander. That's the second paragraph. Total war, third paragraph. In the middle of the effort to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, the tide turned. Bar Kokhba lost the support of Rabbi Akiva. What happened? Bar Kokhba murdered a sage. Now, this is a little complicated. Why would Bar Kokhba murder a Jewish sage? He accused the great rabbi of revealing the secret entrances of the fortress city of Beitar to the Romans. It is now believed that this betrayal was the work of the Jewish Christians who wanted to undermine Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiva then realized that Bar Kokhba no longer possessed the qualities. He couldn't stand behind a person who would kill a rabbi, even if he was tricked into it, and he pulled his support. There was an additional dimension. And that is whether the spiritual failure of Rabbi Akiva's students was the cause, or whether it was the failure of Bar Kokhba to rise to the spiritual heights expected of the Messiah, is beyond our knowledge. For then, out of the blue, this great plague descended and struck. The dream collapsed. For reasons probably will never always remain obscure, the students of Rabbi Akiva were not considered by heaven to have reached the supreme spiritual heights necessary to bring about the Mashiach. See, what's happening here, what is he arguing? And this goes back to the original question, why 33 days? How is this worse than any terrible pogrom, crusade, inquisition, or certainly not the Holocaust?
What was Akiva doing?
Hang on 1 second, what's that? Because this could have been, this looked like that we were on the cusps of some sort of messianic redemption. And the author of this article is bringing in the Rambam, I think, Maimonides, because a lot of us think about the Mashiach. I used to think of this when I was a kid, like, I don't know if I ever told you this, the night before, like, math tests, I said this to you guys once, and checkups at the doctor, I said, daven really hard, the Mashiach would come. Because I hated the doctor, and I hated math. And I thought, oh, the Mashiach's going to come, and I'm going to just, you know, some eagle, because that's what the verse in the prophet says, an eagle will come and lift me up, or first class seats on El Al, I'll be in the presidential suite in King David in 12 hours. Everything, that's the way the Mashiach's going to come, out of nowhere. A lot of rabbis don't agree with that. I think it's a gradual process, a normative, natural, gradual process. And isn't a war to push off your oppressive regime, the Romans? And the leading Torah sage pulls his thousands of rabbis and students and starts infusing that Bar Kokhba revolt with some spirituality. What's it going to become? What could it become? It could have been the Mashiach, but it wasn't. And I actually heard this at a Israel Bonds breakfast over 20 years ago. Rabbi Grimblatt was speaking, and he gave this incredible talk. This is a different, he knew Rabbi Stolper, but he wrote something a little different than this in his book, Exile and Redemption. And he said, I remember it was just guys in the room, so he said, like, Rabosai. He says, gentlemen, we have the same opportunity today. Who were the founders of the State of Israel? Basically, Bar Kochvaniks. Right? Nationalists. Not necessarily religion, not people who are looking to bring the Mashiach, but some great, proud, nationalistic Jews that are willing to fight for Am Yisrael. And we have a choice. We in the religious community have a choice. We could try to do like what Rabbi Akiva did and throw our spirituality, throw our Torah, throw our support. Throw like the whole Orthodox community, he was basically saying, behind the Zionist enterprise and make it into what not, they weren't necessarily trying to create this themselves, but we can make this into something even beyond just simply a safe haven for Jews on the run. But we can make it into the messianic redemption. What kept us from doing it last time? Shelo negu kavod zeh lazeh, the Gemara says, because they failed to show proper respect. If you can't get it together within your own little mini community, one rabbi to the next, one Talmud student to the next, how are you going to inspire some larger, broader revolt against the Romans? You got to have your act together here, and then we can go there and work with them and make something even bigger. And Rabbi Grimblatt, of blessed memory, was arguing, as I still like to argue today, that we are presented with the same exact opportunity with Israel today. Israel today, and we say this every Shabbat, we don't say it's the Mashiach, nobody thought Ben-Gurion was the Messiah. But we say Atchalta de Geula. It could be the beginning of the redemption. But it depends. Because if you just look at it like any other country, it's not going to turn into some sort of messianic redemption if we just treat it like any other kind of thing. But if we bring into our Judaism and our souls and our everything into that movement, then we have the potential to do what Rabbi Akiva tried to do with the Bar Kokhba revolt, which today we can perhaps do with Zionism today. And I just think that's a very, very powerful sort of contemporary message to Lag BaOmer. One last thing, and you could take this home because I don't want to make you so late. I mentioned one last thing, and that was about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the cave. He was one of those students Rabbi Akiva started to learn with. Anybody know why he spent all those years in a cave? Was that on purpose? Why Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai spent all those years in the cave? Well, anybody, any idea why? Like,
were they able to get him?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Romans were still, you know, house-to-house searches. Yeah, yeah. So it was forbidden to assemble and to teach Torah publicly. So he went, and people were hiding out, trying to, you know, it was like the Hanukkah story again and again. So he, the reason he's very, very, and he's buried in Meron, and people flock to Meron every year on his yard site to pray at his grave and to be able to celebrate the Torah that he revealed. What was the Torah that he is accredited with revealing?
The Zohar,
which means the light. It's not like he made this stuff up, but we believe that he was one of the masters of Kabbalah that had received it from teacher to student, teacher to student, and revealed it in his generation. In every generation, there's another. I mean, I the Arizal was in the 16th century. I truly believe that there was one great rabbi. He's not as well known, but we have a lot of his books. His name is Aryeh Kaplan. He wrote a lot of books, and he was a master Kabbalist in his own way. He was not raised in the religious community. He was 49 when he died. He was a physicist. He was a genius. And he actually translated Kabbalistic manuscripts that were never translated before and brought them and revealed it and wrote in such a simple, easy manner. If anybody wants to see, there's one YouTube of Aryeh Kaplan. He was interviewed by some Christian radio show about Kabbalah. It's actually interesting. You can watch it later if you want to see. Just put in Aryeh Kaplan, under YouTube. You'll come up. And he's just a fascinating, sort of revealing a certain depth of Torah that wasn't there before. The depth was there, but it wasn't revealed. That's what I'm trying to say. So we owe him a lot because of the Zohar was just like, without the Zohar, I mean, the Zohar is basically just a commentary on the five books of Moses, Parsha by Parsha. But it's a commentary based on the Kabbalistic tradition, which gives us really a tremendous amount of depth into the more esoteric teachings of about God and about Judaism, the creation of the world, and so on and so forth. So all of this kind of comes together. There's like a little messianic fervor, Kabbalah. I don't even know how to describe it. It's hard to feel it in New York. It's definitely more in Israel. And everybody's just lighting fires and bonfires all over the place. My son, who I spoke with today, just said that there's one around, went from bonfire to bonfire in Jerusalem. Just little
even
kids.
Even the non-religious, like everybody does that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a field day for all the pyromaniac children in Israel. Any questions just about this? I just wanted to give you a little significance about Lag BaOmer. I know it's not, but it is actually a very, very significant event because of all of the themes. And I think the contemporary significance of what we could do with Israel and sort of lending Israel a little more of a religious, spiritual flavor and making something even greater out of it. Because everything in the world has to have a physical component and a spiritual component. So the physical was the Bar Kokhba, the Rabbi Akiva was the spiritual. And today, it's always supposed to be that way. The physical and the spiritual are not supposed to be fighting each other. It's like your body and soul not getting along your whole life. So we shouldn't really be having a situation in Israel where the rabbis are here and the secularists over there. We actually all need each other, just like science and religion needs each other. We're supposed to be living in that kind of era, and that's the messianic time when everyone's going to see how everything was necessary. Yeah.
So, is there significance to, if I'm not mistaken, they started dying on Pesach?
Oh, yeah. During this period of time. He answers that a little later. I didn't answer that question. That's a good point. Why during this period of time? I mean, can anyone think of an answer? Why during this period of time did it happen between Pesach and Shavuot?
Because all we're supposed to be improving ourselves?
Because you're going from Exodus.
To Matan Torah.
Right, you're going from the Exodus from Egypt. You're getting out of your Egypt, and you're going to stand at Torah. You're going to stand at Sinai on Shavuos to receive the Torah. You guys around Shavuos night, it's going to be unbelievable, by the way. We got a theme of technology in Torah. It's going to be cool. You need to be here.
Will there be cut?
No, we don't sleep. You can fall asleep on the table.
Big
we do have a couch. I have a couch in my office, and I have a couch here. Yeah, one couch.
It's
we'll
a period of refinement. That's why, the idea, we're refining ourselves towards Matan Torah.
I think that could be one of the answers. You don't just get to the Torah. You have to kind of, move yourself up.
Prepare yourself.
You know? Which is kind of a cool thing. Any other ideas why this happened now? Why do they all these students die now?
Because they didn't actually die from patriotic persecution.
That's your theory?
No, it's like a
known thing.
I don't know if it's a known thing, but it's like one of the big theories out there that part of the censorship,
it stands to reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Part of the censorship was that they had to blame it on plague instead of blaming it on the Romans executing everyone. But also, a lot of this comes.
Do you think the 24 is a made up number?
I think it's a little too round. It
says 12,000 zugot.
12,000 partners. Rabbi Akiva, his first great 12 years of learning, comes with 12,000 students. He goes back home. His wife is being made fun of. She says, "When's your husband going to be your husband? He's never here." She says, "If I had it this way, I would do 12 more years of my husband going to learn."
It's a little
he
too
goes,
convenient, the 12 and 12.
12,000. Yeah. So, whatever. It's okay.
No, but I never heard that would have been. That makes a lot of sense.
And Rabbi Akiva also, he gets executed later on due to the Hadrianic persecution.
He's in Shema Israel and what he's famous about.
And so, all of it's very connected. The fact that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai everyone is apparently dying around this time due to these revolts, due to Bar Kokhba.
How many people were killed in the revolt, do you know?
I don't think we know. We have no primary sources other than the Talmud.
But Shimon Yochai survived, though. Shimon Bar Yochai didn't die. He survived, you know?
No,
he didn't.
It's his yours.
Should we go to the concert?
Yes, guys, enjoy your concert. We'll see you on Shabbat. Spring Retreat. Oh, by the way, yeah, Monday night also we're having Jason Greenblatt is going to be speaking Monday night here. Yeah.
As celebrating the ending of the students dying versus celebrating because they stopped dying or